once more into the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting, arguably, episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff.
McClure.
Who have the opportunity, and are very excited about it, to really screw things up without realizing it.
Which is a common theme for most people's lives, only in our case, we are actually on the air in front of at least, I would say, tens of maybe ones of people, so we can mess up in a slightly more public setting, mildly. So that's our first disclosure. Next disclosure is this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and that is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. It's not a coincidence. They're the same people talking to you on the air here that sit as principals at that firm. However, we can't offer investment advice on the air because we don't know everybody that's listening. We don't even know if anyone is listening. It's not a very private setting. So
I think Aaron's listening.
We hope so. He is the producer.
And I'm listening.
A producer who should get some high accolades. Aaron is magnificent. The fact that we can't offer investment advice on the air, so what are we doing then if we're not offering advice? Well, hopefully education. We are going to re-educate the population in... Wait a minute. That's not exactly what I... Maybe it is. If you need a good brain cleaning, we're here to do the washing for you. We're here to talk about economics, but in the middle of that, I said education, SEC. Wait a minute. That's not to imply that they think that we are the chosen ones or anointed in any way. The SEC is our regulator, and therefore, if we say something fraudulent, misleading in a context that could hurt someone financially, they're the folks to talk to. It isn't to imply that they have somehow given us some kind of extra authority or privileges or any of that. Anybody that's ever been to the DMV knows that just because you have a driver's license does not mean that they fully support all of your actions. Very similar situation.
They don't?
Correct. That is correct.
I've noticed them out there supporting my actions on a regular basis.
Sir, this is the DMV. We do not have a sense of humor.
Oh, okay.
The SEC is similarly without humor. Mm. They might have a trace of humors, but that's an old school medical problem, not the... So we're offering education, not advice. We are not paying for this program. We pay for advertisements on the station for the program, but we're not paying for the program, and we're going to stand our ground on that issue. And those of you that have been listening the past several weeks know that this is our second to last live broadcast and third to last broadcast on the airwaves of KTEM in general. We've been going 27 years. I think we're the longest running radio program in the listening area, not just in the station. What were you going to say?
Actually, you should title it correctly. It's the penultimate live program.
Yes. A penultimate live program is the title of this program today, which will confuse everyone.
No, not everyone.
Just us.
English teachers all over the country know what that word means.
They just don't listen to our program.
Oh, that's probably true.
That could be the issue there.
Didn't think about that.
So you have a disclosure for us.
Well, my disclosure is a good one, I think. It is that... the information we present on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
We do, however, warranty and guarantee that anything that we do not say on the air is incomplete. Thank you. Now, we have gotten through our disclosures in record time, folks. It only took us 37 minutes this time around. Next time, we're going to reach for 36. Sorry, that was hyperbole. Hyperbole is great unless you're talking about missiles.
Right.
Now, what happened this week in the market?
Well, it stayed at 44 Wall Street all week.
Wait, which market? I thought we were talking about the flea market. Because that
the
one...
New York, we're talking about the New York Stock Exchange here.
Okay,
and it stayed at 44 Wall Street all week. And it did circle the earth 7 times during the week, but only 5 times during the business week.
Is it called circling the earth if the earth is the one doing the circling?
Maybe
the core of the planet.
I don't know. That is an interesting philosophical concept.
A big giant merry-go-round.
It went round and round.
In the
generally
prices,
traveling at about traveling east at about 440 miles an hour.
Tracking the prices and averages in a capitally weighted index, how did the market perform this week?
Oh, well, those of you who follow this or read our newsletter will realize that last week there was a universal, almost universal consensus among the pundits that the market was too high and it was due for a fall in the near future. And we were clearly on the way down and it had peaked and things were going to get bad. So the market reacted to that.
Or something else.
The S&P 500 stock index, affectionately known as SPX, responded by rising 2.5% for the week, mostly on one day, Wednesday. And it closed out the week at 4,719.19, for those of you who track such things. I do. I remember that 4,000 was kind of a trigger point. 4,400 was a good one. So it was the S&P 500 is up almost 23% this year, 32% from last October when we were telling people not to get out of the market. About 22% from where it was 3 years ago. Now, look at those numbers right there. It's up 23% this year, but only up 22% from where it was 3 years ago. That shows you a lot about the nature of the stock market. You don't know when it's going to rise. You don't know when it's going to fall. We don't know when it's going to rise and when it's going to fall. What we know is that you got to be there when it happens or you'll miss it. And generally speaking, I have noticed that the biggest rises in the stock market occur when most people think it's a good idea to not be invested in the stock market.
That is correct. It's very counterintuitive, but not so much when you understand that most people think the same way.
Well, the S&P 500, which is behaving in its usual weird fashion as it does in bull markets, and I hate to say this, but towards the end of bull markets particularly, it's only 1.5% below its all-time high in January 2022. Why do I say that? That it's behaving in a peculiar fashion. About seven stocks are making up most of the return, the vast majority of return in the S&P 500, and we'll get to that in just a second. But the big surge upward was on Wednesday, and it was credited to comments made by Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. Chairman Powell, we refer to him, and we take his printed words and we wave them about and chant.
No, that's Chairman Mao.
Chairman Powell.
We're not carrying around a beige book and chanting or a red book and chanting. So,
well, we very carefully study the beige book.
That is true. That is true.
So, which, by the way, for those of you who don't know it, the beige book is published by the Federal Reserve and basically is a detailed accounting of everything that happens on everything they know about in the economy. It was his comments. Now, this is amazing, an amazing thing. Once during his press conference, Chairman Powell used the word cut.
Yes.
And it was a warning that they don't see any evidence coming up that would cause them to cut. But he used cut interest rates. He used cut for the first time. And it says something about the reporters who were there. And you've read the entire thing, Jake, so you probably know exactly what he said. But basically,
I wanted to get into detail on this after the market. But
I'll let you do that. Okay. But basically, the fact that he said cut is credited with causing the market to surge. Well, first, it caused the bond market to surge downward in yield. Anyway, so the U.S. Treasury note, which is the thing we follow. Let me get back to the stocks a minute. Not to miss out on the party, our other followed stock market indicator, the CRSP U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index, which does have a symbol, but it's really long and complicated. It rose 3.34% for the week to close at 2481.75. It's up 6.25% this year and 14% since October of last year. Still 4.45% below it was when 2022 began. Why do we report on that? Well, one, we find it interesting. And secondly, it is a good correlation with what the rest of the market outside of those seven stocks are doing. The market is up. Yes, it's definitely up this year. It's up about 6.25 to 6.5%, the broad market, if you take those seven big stocks out, those seven big tech stocks. Let's see, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, that was the one that got a lot of press. It dropped the interest rate, the yield on it dropped from 4.23% last week to 3.91% on Friday. And if you follow that thing, and of course we do, that's a big change. That's a decline in yield of 7.6%. And it's the lowest yield. This is what the market, the pundits said the market was excited. The market, people who buy and sell daily on the market, we're excited about. That is the lowest interest rate, the lowest yield since July.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which didn't look to me as being particularly impressive, but apparently people... What happens in the stock market is when people who have money in that's, quote, burning a hole in their pocket, end quote, really want to buy, but there's some reason for them not buying, like the Fed's going to raise interest rates and create a recession, and they just kind of are squirming around wanting to buy, and then somebody buys because the Federal Reserve chairman said a word in a press conference when everybody was too busy to listen to it. And then there is this thunderous rush forward to buy. So it dropped to 3.91%, below 4% for the first time since July, which is, I guess, really good. However, the short-term rates, the one that the Federal Reserve directly controls, didn't do anything. All the less than one-year maturities are above 5% with the 2-month treasury holding the 1-month treasury both yielding 5.54%, which is where the money markets are. So the treasury yield curve effectively became more inverted this week, which of course resulted in the stock market shooting upward. And if you know anything about what the relation between those two traditionally is, the more inverted the yield curve is, the treasury yield curve, the more the market historically has declined. So since it got more inverted this week, the stock market went up, which tells you short term, the movements of the stock market are worse than random. They're counterintuitive. Anyway, West Texas Intermediate crude oil didn't get the message either that caused the 10-year T-note to drop and the stock market to rise. It finished out the week at 71.74, about 50 cents higher than last week, and within the range of randomness that it's basically does. It's and that's the lowest price we've seen since June. So looked good from here.
All right. Well, we have two questions out there from loyal listeners. you already mentioned Inquisitor John, our primo Inquisitor. Marty also has a question, and they both have to do with the Federal Reserve. Imagine that, as that's being the largest news this week. So Marty has a question here. And it's based on listening to our program and individual conversations. And his is, why would the Fed lower rates when higher rates help pay the federal deficit? Well, first off, higher rates do not help pay the federal deficit. It's the opposite. When rates are high, the deficit is being charged higher interest. The deficit is 1 year's negative. So if you bring in taxes and it's not enough to pay for everything, you've got to borrow for that year. That's the deficit for the year. Then you have the national debt, which is all the deficits put together. So that's just to begin with. The federal deficit is in no way helped by higher interest rates. That is the opposite. However, or this is kind of the point that he's going to. He says it smells like it has something to do with the election. And then he says, the Fed does not have the best record in fixing anything. You said that rates would not go down for some time. Is this Fed engineering? I'm trying to understand the tea leaves. I believe in your surmises of the market, and I can't wait for your brilliant and informative as usual take. So thank you for all of the flattery there. Brilliant and informative. I think he's referring to the gleam from my bald pate. It is quite brilliant occasionally. Now, the thoughts that go on underneath the reflection, maybe not so much, but I wanted to tie something together here. Both of our questions from faithful listeners have to do with tea leaves. So I'm going to address that first. John's question was, how does PwC read the tea leaves for 2024? He says, Marty says, I'm trying to understand the tea leaves. So tea in U.S. dollars per kilogram has averaged $3.25 for the last decade. It is currently trading at $3.25. So as much as everything is weird in the world, the tea leaves are saying exactly the same thing that they've said for the last 10 years. Now that we can move on to the next question. What I talked about and what we have talked about on the radio and in person is that short-term rates are not the thing that most people are concerned with. It's the long-term rates that people are really upset about. If you want to buy a house, if you want to refinance, if you are trying to develop property, those long-term rates are high, and people don't like that. It's expensive. Well, when the Federal Reserve this week, when Chairman Powell had his press conference, and I've got the transcript here, the reporters asked questions with the word cut in it 20 times. Chairman Powell said the word cut once. Why did he say it and what did he say it about? I'm not going to direct quote this part. I'm going to paraphrase it. What he said is that it will be too late to start cutting when we reach our target of 2%, because then we might be in a spiral that could lead to deflation. So we would want to start before then. What does that mean? It means if you look back at what we've said over the past 6 months or so, we've been saying, hey, it looks like we're hitting month by month the Fed target. Our year over year still looks high, but each month for the past 6 months, we've been well within the range that is the target for the Fed. Everybody reports the annualized stuff looking at 12 months to today, and we're still 3.7% up from where we were 12 months ago, or 3.5% or somewhere in there. It's been slowly falling. But if you look back at an annualized inflation for the past 6 months, we're right at that 2% mark, which is why he's saying we would start to look at this in March, because we need to get ahead of it. So if you look back 6 months and then look ahead 6 months, we're talking about May or June. He wants to get ahead of it. Okay, that's all reasonable. So all of that is just some background. The last question that was asked of Chairman Powell is the one that I think is the one that most people really want to care about, and they don't know. They don't even know that it happened, which is what's going on the long-term interest rates. This is the mortgage area. This is the 30-year and the 10-year bond area. 10-year note, I'm sorry. So when you're talking about mortgages, we're all this conversation, and we saw the drop in the 30-year bond rate, and we saw a drop in the 10-year note rate at the U.S. Treasury. During that same time period, we saw 30-year mortgages drop 0.008%. That's a percent. So if you keep putting the zeros out the front to turn it into a whole number, you realize that's a blip. It's, we had more than that on a month where, or a day when the Federal Reserve is not talking. So in essence, nothing happened in the mortgage market. We saw rate drops at the 30-year level in the Treasury market and the 10-year of the Treasury market, but we didn't see anything in the mortgage market. Why? Megan Casella from Barron's asked the last question of the conference. And what her question was is about the balance sheet, which is the Fed's primary focus. For the past, 12 months, that has been the number one topic that the Federal Reserve talks about. And she says, can you talk us through what the latest thinking is, considering possible rate cuts? And has there been any consideration of altering the pace of quantitative tightening at all? That QT, quantitative tightening, what is that? First off, that is the sale by the Federal Reserve of mortgage-backed securities and long-term U.S. Treasury bonds and short-term U.S. Treasury bonds. They have a very, very high balance sheet. They've got a lot of them on the books because they bought them up during the pandemic. So this was part of their quantitative easing, QE, if you guys remember all of that. And then we had the taper tantrums when they stopped easing. They weren't buying from the market. What Chairman Powell says is very clear. It doesn't get clearer than this. There's no double talk in his words at all. Chairman Powell's answer was, we are not talking about altering the pace of QT right now, just to get that out of the way. So balance sheets seem to be working pretty much as expected. He goes on to say that we've already sold back $1.2 trillion. How much more do they have to do? About $8 trillion left to sell into the market, to get back to what we were pre-pandemic. Okay, what does that have to do with anything? Well, let's kind of give you the background. When the pandemic hit, the Federal Reserve started buying bonds and mortgages. What did that do? Well, if there's a lot of people out there or a lot of money out there to buy mortgages, it means that more banks can issue mortgages. It means there's more competition in the mortgage market because they can turn around and sell to the Fed as well as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Morgan Stanley and all the people that want to buy mortgages. The Federal Reserve came in and they were about a third of the mortgage market there during the pandemic. That's really big. I can't express that very clearly to you, except to say it's massive. A huge amount of money was made available to banks to give mortgages. Then as things calm down, the pandemic's starting to calm, we've got good numbers in the bank, the Federal Reserve says, all right, we're going to stop buying as many. So these are the quantitative, this is not quantitative tightening yet. We're still easing. They're tapering their purchases. So they're buying less. So they went down to about a quarter of the market. And interest rates started slowly to climb on mortgages. Not very much, just a little. They hadn't started raising short-term interest rates yet. Then they said, we're not buying. We are no longer going to be buying mortgage securities, nor are we going to be buying big bonds, except when some of ours mature, we'll buy one to replace it. Okay, that was the taper tantrum, when the Federal Reserve stopped buying those assets. And that's when we started to see some real movement upward in interest rates for mortgages. Then came quantitative tightening, when they came out and they said, we're going to start selling bonds. Not only are we not going to be buying from banks the mortgages, we're going to be competing on selling mortgages into the market, which means go ahead.
And at that point, the markets and the economy went, ugh,
yeah,
because they felt the tightening.
Yeah, that tightened hard. That's when interest rates on mortgages started up through the roof. That's figurative and literal. If you live in a house that has a high interest rate on it, you know that that interest rate is affecting your roof, whether or not the dog is barking. All right. So that being said, quantitative tightening is the sale of those bonds back into the market. Not only is the Federal Reserve not buying the mortgages from the bank, it's competing with the bank on selling the mortgages, which means that the banks have to offer higher and higher interest rates on those mortgages in order for it to be attractive to a buyer on the other end. And what Chairman Powell said is, we're not changing that. That part's remaining the same. If we cut lower interest rates, if we go lower interest rates, it's only going to be on the short end of the spectrum. The short end is what we charge banks or what we give to banks on an overnight loan, an overnight deposit. This isn't the 30-year stuff, which is why the mortgage market didn't move at all during this week of massive uproar on Wall Street. The mortgage market was unaffected, because what Chairman Powell said is, if we're lowering rates to fight inflation, we still have to deal with a big balance sheet. We still have to sell this stuff back. Now, if we hit a point where it looks like a recession, I would anticipate that the Federal Reserve would stop selling into the market. But right now, they're selling about $90 billion a month into the market. $30 billion of that is mortgage stuff, and $60 billion of that is U.S. Treasuries, which causes interest rates to remain high. And I know that there's convolution there, but it's basically, if you have eight banks that all have lots of money and want to loan it to you, then they're going to compete to get that interest rate as low as possible. When you're negotiating with them and you say, I want a mortgage, and they say, I'll give you one for 5%, and the other one says, well, we'll give you one for 4.5%, and the other one says, oh, no, we'll bring it down to 4.25%. That's a negotiation in an auction market where they have a lot of cash on hand. That cash is gone. When you go to get a mortgage, there are fewer people offering them, much fewer, and the interest rates are higher, because they can't turn around and sell them to the Federal Reserve as well as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In fact, they have to compete with the Federal Reserve in selling them into the market. So the competition has gone from keeping interest rates as low as possible to being competitive by having a higher interest rate. And that's the wrap-up, a very clear wrap-up there, is that don't expect the long-term rates on mortgages to come down when the Federal Reserve starts lowering its short-term rates. That's not what anybody wants to hear. Sorry for being the bearer of bad news there, but that's clearly what he said as his closing statement at the press conference.
If I could add something to that, there's a couple of things here. One, the fact that interest rates declined back to where they were in July, which
on
is
the,
still...
On the short-term side, yeah.
On the longer term. The fact that long-term interest rates bump downward a little bit doesn't change our opinion that longer-term rates will continue to rise over the next, as a matter of fact, several publications I take that are very thoughtful and have a good track record have also suggested that longer term rates are going to continue to rise. The only way we can get back to a normal yield curve is for the Federal Reserve. First, the Federal Reserve, which is set the short term rates between 5.25 and 5.5%. There is the best predictions I've read from the people who are good at predicting these things suggest. And there's even some members of the Federal Reserve who've supported that 4.5% to 5% by the end of next year, short-term rates. Well, if we eventually will get back to a non-inverted yield curve, a normal yield curve, where longer-term interest rates are higher than shorter-term interest rates, this is a very unnatural situation being created by the Fed right now. The economy, if the Fed backs out of trying to tightly control things, shorter term loans have a lower interest rate than longer term loans. Therefore, the bond yield curve, the treasury bond yield curve, will be positive again. So how do we get back there? Well, for starters, historically, short term treasury securities have yielded around 3%. And that's in a normal economy. Now, we had an abnormal economy since the banking crisis in 2008. We've had an abnormal economy. And there's some good reasons for it, and we can go into that in great detail. But if, let's say, be very positive and say it's 2.5%. If the Fed wants inflation to be 2%, then they need to charge a little more than inflation for T-bills, so they say 2.5%. Well, that means that longer-term rates need to be higher than that, and they probably will be higher than that and continue to rise. So we haven't changed our position on that. And I got one other thing, but you wanted to say something.
Yeah, and I wanted to address the last part of, or the, maybe the middle part. Some major portion of the question from Marty is this smells a little bit like politics. Everything smells like politics when we're coming into an election year. So the Federal Reserve is supposed to be insulated from that. Supposed to be. So and I'm saying supposed to be because it's important to know that politics is everything. Politics means people. But I'm going to remind folks of something. Jerome Powell was nominated to the board of the Federal Reserve by Barack Obama. He was nominated to the chair of the Federal Reserve by Donald Trump. That's important to note that Janet Yellen was endorsed by Donald Trump. She's now the Treasury Secretary for Joe Biden. But if you look at the history of the Federal Reserve, it's apolitical. It's as apolitical as we want the Supreme Court to be. It is supposed to be led by academics at this point. And Jerome Powell is an academic. Bernanke was an academic. Yellen was an academic. These are people that we want doing this, not people that are progressive or conservative or in light of the new president or in light of what Congress is thinking now. None of that should be part of whether or not we have inflation or deflation. When we look at why he says we might be cutting rates in March, it totally makes sense with the math. And the math isn't affected by Bidenomics or Trumponomics or any of the anomics because it doesn't have this. This is, I go back to this regularly. The president usually has very, very little control of the current economic situation. Even when we started a trade war under Donald Trump, we did it in a booming period of the market, a booming period of our economy. It didn't cause a recession. It didn't change the direction of the economy almost at all. It may have influenced later some inflation, but a lot of things influence inflation. So giving a credit to Biden for not being in a recession or being in a recession, he hasn't done anything that could have prevented it or caused a recession. Neither did Donald Trump. The president doesn't control the economy. We just give them credit or blame. And I know that this is one of those things that I come back to regularly. And if it really makes you feel better to blame Biden, it's okay. You get an emotional benefit because you can blame someone for it. That's the anthropomorphism of a mob. We are the economy, all of us. How we determine we spend our money on a day-to-day basis is what changes our economy. It's what causes inflation and deflation. And we're a massive mob. And the mob is made up of a pretty even mix of Republicans and Democrats. And when the Democrats say, hey, we're going to bring back the estate tax, and then the Democrats say, no, we can't do that because we have a bunch of rich Democrats now. Or the Republicans say, we're going to stop all aid to foreign countries until we get a wall built. Then you get the rest of the mob looks at the extreme ends of either side of the political party, and they say, no, that's not how it goes. So we just passed a defense bill in Congress that was Democrats and Republicans voting together against the extreme right wing of the conservative party. This is what happens normally. And we're very polarized right now, so it doesn't happen as often. But when we're talking about the economy, it isn't Biden saying, you know, I think we should make the economy better today so I can get elected. What could he do to, there's no like lever in the Oval Office that he says, okay, let's turn that to good economy or bad economy. There isn't a lever. You can lower taxes, and that may cause the economy to do well, but then we can't pay our bills. You can raise taxes, and maybe that'll affect the economy in a negative way. Donald Trump did that. Donald Trump raised taxes. He also lowered taxes. When did he raise taxes? That's what the tariffs were. When did he lower taxes? The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So all of that is to say politics and the Federal Reserve should not be in the same sentence. And when we look at the math that the Federal Reserve is using as their model for when they lower or raise short-term interest rates and when they end quantitative tightening, nothing is in there about, you know, we think the economy is going to change because there's a different person or the same person in the Oval Office. Because it doesn't. Okay, you've been waiting to add to this.
Yeah, well, I want to explain something that I have to re-explain to myself on a regular basis. We've talked about it before, and if anybody out there thoroughly understands this, first, I apologize, and secondly, you need to be doing what we do. What causes interest rates to rise and fall? And it's supply and demand, pure and simple.
Absolutely.
Now, short term, the Federal Reserve sets the rates because that's the interbank lending rate, and the interbank lending rate affects how banks loan money and everything. But long-term, interest rates are set by the market. Now, the Federal Reserve right now is a major participant in the market, but that will end. When we talk about the fact that they're shrinking their balance sheet, they are selling bonds effectively into the market. Now, what does that mean? That means that there is a greater supply than demand at this point. When there's a greater supply than demand, prices drop. In other words, when there's more stuff and fewer people who want to buy the stuff, then in order to sell the stuff, you have to lower the prices. That's the nature of markets. The Federal Reserve is selling mortgage bonds and treasury bonds into the market to shrink its balance sheet. Why is it doing that? Well, it's doing that because it wants to get rid of them so it can have cash again. Now, why does it want to have cash again? Because the next time we are faced with a recession, they have to have a lot of cash to go out and buy bonds and flush bonds into the market. So they're doing the perfectly reasonable thing, and there's something making loud. So what we've got going on right now is the Federal Reserve selling bonds, which raises interest rates. Well, how does it raise interest rates if the bond market goes down? It comes back to the simple thing. A bond, generically, is a $1,000 loan. And if you have a bond that is, listen, I'm going to use an absurd, not terribly absurd, but slightly absurd numbers here. If you have a bond that's at 5%, it's a 30-year bond, let's just say, and you've purchased it, and it's a 5% bond, and you purchased it from the issuer, so it's paying you $50 a year. Let's just say that because of the fact that the bond market has declined, interest rates go up to 10%. Now, if somebody buys a $1,000 bond, they get $100 a year. And you decide to sell your bond that's paying you $50 a year on the open market when you can buy a new one that's paying you $1,000 a year. How much is your bond worth? Well, the gut reaction is worth $500. It's actually worth a little more than that because at the end, the issuer will likely pay you back $1,000. So maybe $600, $700 is what your bond is worth, whereas you paid $1,000 for it. That is a falling bond market, which we have had for the last 2 years, by the way. It's come back a little bit recently, but the three-year returns on bond portfolios that are in intermediate bond portfolios are still generally negative. Even with all interest rates reinvested, they're generally negative at this point. I just looked at one that has, over the last 3 years, it's done really, really well. It's returned 1.5% a year, which is obviously lower than inflation, which means that the investment lost money during the period. So the supply and demand drives the long-term interest rates, and we're going to have more demand. And why are we going to have more demand? Because the economy is booming. It's continuing to boom. And if you understand all that stuff, and I bored you to death because you understand it, you need to come work with us.
Yeah.
And if you didn't understand it, you're like me. Go ahead, Jay.
The last ceiling argument about this, this may upset the Democrats. Jerome Powell is a registered Republican. He served under George H.W. Bush as Undersecretary of Treasury. So having said that, he still looks apolitical in his choices. He got his degree from Georgetown University, and before that, Yale. He is an academic, and the politics of this don't come into it. How do I know he's a registered Republican? Because when Obama was nominating him, Obama, let that be known, the president of the United States was a Democrat and said, this academic is the best guy I can find to sit on the board of the governors. This is before he was chairman. When Donald J. Trump said, this is the guy that needs to be the chairman, there may have been more political consideration there. But this is important to recognize that politics on the board for the Federal Reserve is a big no-no. And if we were to say Jerome Powell the same way we talk about Supreme Court justices, where you say the name of the justice was appointed to the Supreme Court by, and then you name the president as if that means something, then Jerome Powell was Obama and Trump. What does that mean? Well, it means that's the way we want the Federal Reserve to be. And this is something that comes up regularly because the Federal Reserve is often looked at as being a political institution. Greenspan caused George H.W. Bush to lose the election to Bill Clinton. Greenspan has some Democratic tendencies, but that's not why he caused a recession. He was fighting inflation. And this is just, and George H.W. Bush understood that at the time. He talked about it. He said, you know, this is what cost me the election. Bill Clinton would not have been able to say it's the economy, stupid, if we didn't have a recession. And the recession wasn't caused by President Bush. It was caused by Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan did it on purpose, but it had nothing to do with politics. It just happened to cause a shift in presidential elections. So just there's a lot of moving pieces in there, but what one of the few things, I mean, there's a couple of things having to do with government and semi-governmental organizations that I think the United States is doing extremely well. Our military is probably paramount there. And secondarily would be the Federal Reserve. And we got to play some commercials. So if you would like to join the conversation, we have email addresses waiting at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's the personal wealth coach, or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important announcements from our sponsors. We'll be right back. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure. Starring. That's interesting.
Yes, we are stars, or at least star particles. We're all kind of star particles, so we can all be starring together. It's better than being planeting, because we're also planet particles. So, but it just doesn't sound as good to say, today, planeting in this radio program is Jeff and Jake McClure. No, just doesn't have the same kind of stellar ring to it.
Literally.
Literally, yes. Marty just emailed saying, thanks for the info about Federal Reserve stuff. John's question was in the same kind of vein as Marty's. What's going on in the market? Is this a bull market or is it a sugar high? And you kind of touched on that at the beginning of the hour, talking about this is looking more like the end of a bull market, like the last third of the stretch of a bull market. And it very well could be. What does that mean? Just as a side note, the part of the market that has been doing quite well in the past month and a half or so, and I hesitate to say this on the air because it might cause people to realize it, is the mid-cap value portion of the market. What is mid-cap value? Value is any company that, value and growth are two, let me stop and say, let's give the definition of value and growth. When somebody talks about a growth stock or a value stock, it's easier to start with growth. Growth, when you look at everything that a company owns, and then you look at the stock price of that company and you add all the stocks together and you say, this company owns $100 million worth of stuff. And they have, that's after all their debts are taken care of and everything. Their net worth is $100 million. Now, in the market, we don't use the word net worth. That would be too easy. Instead, we're going to make up two completely different words to confuse the public massively. We're going to either call it book value or total equity, because why else would we use those words? It means net worth. So the net worth of a company, if you take all the stuff they own minus all the stuff they owe and say this fictional company is worth $100 million, yet they're in the stock market and the stock market is valuing them much higher than that. People are buying their stock even though their net worth is $100 million and they don't have any earnings right now. People are buying them because they think whatever they've just invented is about to change the world. That's a growth company, because people aren't buying it based on what the company's worth, but what they project the company will be worth and what they project the company's earnings will be. They're valuing it as if they expect a huge amount of growth. Otherwise, why would you spend $1 billion to buy a $100 million company? Well, let's ask that of Elon Musk and his $44 billion purchase. The idea is you would expect a great deal of growth. Conversely, if you've done all that math and you find that the net worth of this company is $100 million and you look at the stock market and the stock market's valuing them at $80 million, that's something we would call a value pick. If the stock market's valuing them at $100 million, we still call that a value company. It's being valued for what it owns. And over the past 2 years, value companies have been beat up a lot more than growth companies. We've talked about this quite a lot, the big seven, the magnificent seven of the big growth companies that are taking over the S&P 500, that are running the world, that everybody's buying them. While that was going on, people were selling mid-sized banks, they were selling industrial firms, they were selling power companies. And the mid-cap value sector was being beat up. And we have, for the last 2 years, been saying this is where we need to be investing, because the prices, the net worth of a company is $100 million and the market is willing to sell it to us at $70 million. That makes sense. We'll buy a little piece of that, because even if they go bankrupt right now, when they sell all their assets and pay off their debts, we're still left with a profit. That's the Warren Buffett mentality. And that's the part of the market that's taking off right now. So is that a sugar high? Not until we see those really, really thoroughly underpriced companies come up to at least their own net worth. So we're not in sugar high territory in that part of the market. Are we in sugar high territory for Alphabet, for Tesla, for Apple? Maybe we've been there for a while. But the whole concept of AI has kicked in, and that's what's been the big surge on the growth side.
The thing about a sugar high, if you want to call it that, meaning that the market is run up for some weird reason. That occurs when the Federal Reserve is dumping money into the market. That's a sugar high.
They've stopped flogging us with a whip is what's just happened. That's not necessarily a sugar high. It may feel like it. We're getting some relief. Well, it's not constant pain.
They're pulling money out of the market right now. So this is not a sugar high. This is a tech high. And it's important to remember that 1994, Alan Greenspan uttered the words irrational exuberance about the market being too high because a few stocks were up because of techs, but it was 5 years later before the thing started down. So the market, parts of the market can be dramatically overpriced for a long time before they start down. And the last leg of that bull market lasted 5 years. This one could easily last six or five or whatever years before we get into it. And we are about out of time for the first hour.
And I want to come back to the tea leaves. Tea prices per U.S. dollar per kilogram are right at where the 10-year average is. So when we read the tea leaves, what we're seeing is $3.25 per kilogram. And you can look that up in the commodity prices. So if you're into reading tea leaves, it's going to cost you the same amount as it has on average over the last 10 years. And we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. But if you would like to join the conversation or talk to us off the air, we actually do talk to people. We are real live people. If you would like to talk to us off the air, you can call us locally at
254-947-1111.
And get voicemail during the weekend, but real live people during the week. You can reach that same line toll-free, should you still have a landline, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. And I've noticed that number isn't used quite as often as it used to be for some reason. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can find our made for podcast faces. You can contact us through the contact form. You can email us directly. You can listen to our radio program going back lots of years. You can find us wherever the podcasts are. We've got podcasts out there. And contact us through the contact form or Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com.